You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Coming up next, I talked to the chief executive of Toha Toha, Mandy Henk. Mandy is a librarian, writer, and advocate for healthy and vibrant commons. She was named a 2012 Library Journal Mover and Shaker for her work as a founding member of the People's Library at Occupy Wall Street, and is the author of Economy, Ecology, and Equity, The Path to a Carbon Neutral Library. We discussed the open access to information in our new digital world and what it means, and how profit-based models for accessing educational or academic texts affect Aotearoa's populations, as well as affect the researchers who are producing such work. I started by kind of getting Mandy to introduce herself and introduce what Toha Toha is.
We're a small nonprofit that grew out of the New Zealand Creative Commons affiliate. We focus on issues of access to information and digital justice sort of issues to ensure that the digital world that we're building is as fair as possible.
The digital world that we're building, it's quite a big one. What current things do you see as causing injustice?
Well, I think that there are a real range of issues that are causing injustice in our digital world, but they all really come down to inequality in that world and the way in which people exercise power in that world. So you have things like surveillance capitalism and sort of data-driven profiteering that you see in the big Silicon Valley companies like Facebook, for example. And then you also have inequalities in like academia in terms of who has access to information and knowledge and who doesn't have access to information and knowledge. And at the same time, I think you also have real concerns around bad actors, both sort of state bad actors and just regular bad actors, manipulating the system via propaganda at a level that we really haven't seen before this.
There's, I guess, three target areas there. What work does Toha Toha do to combat these kind of issues or injustices that we have in our digital world?
Well, we're a fairly small nonprofit, so what we've been focusing on lately is open access to information. Right now, the system of scholarly communication, so the way in which scholars report their results and sort of talk to each other, is a system that's largely behind paywalls. And we would like to see those paywalls taken down and ensure that the system is open to everyone. But we also want to ensure that that system isn't replaced with a system where those publishers transition into data-driven metrics companies. So what we want to see is essentially an opening of that system as well, so that PBRF and other systems for researcher evaluation aren't becoming a profit center for those academic publishers.
What do you see that meaning in Aotearoa? How does New Zealand fare in your eyes?
Well, I think we're doing some things really well. For example, we have right now 51% of our research is published openly, of our university-based research. We have a lot more to go, 49%, to get that the rest of the way towards open, but we've made some really good progress. Where I think we have a lot more work to do is around reforming our system of researcher evaluation. So the PBRF, the Performance-Based Research Fund. Until we actually reform that, I think that any system of open access that we bring in isn't likely to have as much success and get as much traction. We have to do both at the same time.
How do we reform this system?
I think there are a couple of different ways that we can reform the system. One is that we need to center treaty principles. Right now, the PBRF system is largely based on the UK system and Australia system, and we need to work on a system that has been built by New Zealand academics for New Zealand academics. I think that we need to work on building solidarity between departments and between campuses to ensure that we're not being sort of caught up in this sort of metrics-driven frenzy that I think has driven a lot of what led to the system that we have now. And I also think that we need to work on protecting the humanities. A lot of the work that's been done around metrics makes a lot of sense in a science context, so it might make sense for a physicist, for example, but then when you try and apply that system to historians or to classicists, you end up with something that's not only unfair, but also just doesn't make any sense.
I guess a common thing that people bring up in rebuttal to kind of open access to information and education is that the workers or the researchers who create this work aren't getting recognized for their work. How do you find an equitable balance between that critique and providing equitable access or democratic access of the consumers of the knowledge?
Well, the way that you do that is you reform PBRF too, to ensure that folks who are publishing in open access journals are able to get the same sort of credit. And the fact is that there's really good evidence showing that publishing open access leads to, I think it's 3.5 times more impact and more citations, as well as I think it's twice as likely to be used in policy-based documents. So open access publishing leads to really great impact, which is a really great outcome that we say that we want. So we just need to privilege it correctly.
You mentioned centering the tenets of Te Tiriti o Waitangi before in reforming our digital world. What does that mean on kind of like a practical level?
I am not the right person to ask that. I would ask Maori academics what they think and how they would like to see that enacted. Tara McAllister has done some really good work lately. She published a paper called Why Isn't My Professor Maori? And I would go to her and to other scholars who are working in this area and ask them to the table, invite them to the table to do a reform of the system. Right now, Maori academics are about 5% of the total academic workforce in New Zealand. So it's a tiny number, and I hate to ask them to do more work, but I can't answer that for you. Only they can.
Do you think that they've for too long been denied access at the table?
I think that that's what they have said. I think that there's been really lively scholarly literature about this, and I think a seat at the table is part of it. But I think we also have to look at the way that the existing system is reinforcing the inequities that we've already identified.
Obviously, like there have been a few things that have come up over the last year, and you've kind of touched on them in general in terms of like data, and I guess you've got the big cases that some people may be aware of through Netflix documentaries, etc. And then you've got kind of the alternative side of that, something like Ballincat, which is an open source journalism site. And I guess it's also been brought to news or brought to light by the Julian Assange case of our kind of right to know information. Where does that sit as well within the reforms that we should or need to make to our system? Where would it sit kind of in a rights framework perhaps for you moving forward? Is this something that we need to look into in this new digital world?
I think so, but what I would do is be really careful to pull apart things like journalism, which journalism has always relied on advertising and reader support, and I don't see that business model changing, and academic publishing. Where academic publishing is different is we actually pay those researchers. So those researchers in New Zealand almost all actually work for the New Zealand government. So we're already paying them for their work. The publishers who publish their work don't reimburse them with royalties or anything like that. So that piece of work should be different, and it should be open because we've already paid for it. We, the public at large, have already paid for it. Journalism, I think that we need to work really hard to make sure that everyone has good access to journalism. I mean, I remember when newspapers were like $2.50 a pop a day. And that's probably a reasonable amount to expect people to pay. So journalism is something that I would separate from academic publishing, and I think that the business models that support them are reasonably different.
You have talked about reforming the system, and I guess it becomes a government issue at some point. How does this become a topic of conversation for the government to discuss?
Well, we're working on it right now with a public engagement campaign. One of the things with the folks who have supported open access for a long time is that there hasn't been a lot of attempt to engage with the general public. There hasn't been an attempt to help them understand that that moment when they're on the internet and they find an article that they want and then they discover it costs $45, is actually tied into a problem that we're all having, right? We all have that moment when we've done a Google search, we found an interesting article that is going to meet our information need, and all of a sudden we're being asked to give money. So what we're trying to do is to engage the public through videos, which we have available on our website, a declaration that people can sign to say that they want the system to change, as well as a report if people are interested in sort of more detail. So our hope is that if we start talking about it with people and we get people involved with our declaration, the institutions within government and outside of government that can work to ensure that the system that we're building is new and different and better will be more easily mobilized.
This is a perhaps difficult question, but do you see a current time frame on perhaps when we can create a more perhaps democratic digital world?
That's a really good question. I think that in terms of time frame, there's a lot happening right now to change. And I think that we're going to see significant change over the next 2 to 5 years. Where I think things get really difficult and where I think things are going to perhaps start to stall out is the decarbonization part of that. So right now we're in a situation where we need to dramatically reduce our carbon emissions, and our data system is only increasing them, and often by significant amounts, even when you consider the use of alternative energy to power data centers. So a core part of this process has to be deciding how much we actually want to be digital and how we want to ensure that the material basis for the digital world is equitable, just, and not carbon emitting. I think that's the really hard piece of work that we're only just starting on right now.
Right. And for the listeners, can you explain this kind of the issue of decarbonization around data? Because I think for a lot of people, they see the digital world as something that's up in this cloud. But when we're talking about the decarbonization, we are talking about the effects it has on the physical world. Are we not?
Absolutely, we're talking about the effects on the physical world. So as they say, the cloud is just another word for someone's computer. And those computers, too often the clouds that we're relying on are actually in Australia, which means they're likely to be powered by coal, which is a huge step backwards for anything that we're doing onshore here. So each of those data centers can be responsible for emitting quite a lot of carbon. How much carbon isn't something I can tell you because the companies aren't telling us. There's no transparency around reporting that right now. So what we need to do is to figure out how much carbon is actually being emitted and how we can change our system so that we're working on a system that isn't emitting any carbon at all.
To make a more environmentally equitable and socially equitable digital world and even practical world, I guess it relies on getting those kind of companies that you've just mentioned, as well as those who are behind the kind of big data drives, to a table. How does that work?
I think it's something that's really in the early stages of happening right now. I think that ultimately it's going to require governments to bring them to the table. But I think right now, starting to talk about it and get some sort of information and awareness campaigns going, it's probably the best that we can actually do. Ultimately, I think that we're going to have to make some really hard decisions about how much of our lives we want to be digital and how much of our remaining carbon budget we want to devote to this project.
Do you think conversations perhaps like the Facebook call will have an effect on creating this conversation at a louder volume or to a larger audience?
Do you mean the Christchurch call?
The Christchurch call, rather, sorry.
Absolutely. I think that work on the Christchurch call is a good step in the right direction. My hope, though, is that we can get really wide public engagement, and I don't know how much wide public engagement there is right now around Christchurch call issues outside of the internet community. The internet community is great, and I think that they do really good work around this, but we need to make sure that we're engaging with everyone more broadly, because now we're all part of the internet community, right?
Most definitely. And so that would be done through public awareness, I guess.
I think public awareness and making places for people to come and talk and have these conversations and sort of setting a table that everyone feels comfortable at.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.